From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how to read a dead body. We talk with medical examiner Michael Bodden about his 30-plus years investigating homicide, suicide, and accidental death. He's worked on the investigation of the JFK assassination, the Klaus von Bülow case, and now on the World Trade Center bombing. Bodden is the director of the Forensic Sciences Unit for the New York State Police, a consultant to the FBI, and the subject of a new HBO documentary. Also, NATO and the changing face of Europe. We talk with Timothy Garton Ash, author of In Europe's Name, Germany and the Divided Continent. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a live performance of Bellini's opera I Puritani. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is paying a very brief visit to Ukraine today. He says an agreement will be signed that dismantles more than 1,500 Soviet-era nuclear warheads now in Ukraine. Mr. Clinton says the accord will strengthen world security. He held a brief news conference today with Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk, who will sign the dismantlement agreement this Friday in Moscow. Earlier today, Mr. Clinton met Eastern European leaders in Prague. Four countries are accepting NATO's offer to join the organization in a limited manner. Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic will become partners for peace. They don't have the entire security guarantees that a full NATO partner would enjoy, but President Clinton says he is reassuring the Eastern European countries their security is paramount to the United States.
During the Cold War, the security of the Western Alliance was defined by the division of Europe. Our new security must be defined by Europe's integration, the integration of a broader Europe based on military cooperation, robust democracies, and market economies. That was my message in Brussels, where I met with our NATO and European community allies. And it will be my message as I travel to Moscow.
There are reports that President Clinton will ask that a special counsel be appointed to look into his investment in an Arkansas real estate deal. The announcement comes as Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole is calling for a special Senate panel to investigate the same matter. Investigators are trying to find out if the president and Mrs. Clinton improperly benefited from a business partnership with the operator of a failed Arkansas savings and loan. They want to know if SNL money was improperly deposited into a real estate account. President Clinton has denied any wrongdoing. The Competitiveness Council says most large firms will see a net savings if the Clinton health care plan is approved by Congress. NPR's Carolyn Clark Kelly reports.
The studies indicate that manufacturing, communications, and transportation companies would likely see their health bills go down under the Clinton health plan. These are the companies that tend to already spend the most on providing health care for both current and retired employees. General Motors alone accounts for about 1% of the nation's health care spending. Michigan Democrat Donald Riegel argues that situation must change.
In these days of global competition, it's clear to me that we cannot afford a health care system that penalizes the companies in strategic industries that are most directly affected by foreign competition.
Riegel says he expects to see plenty of changes made in the Clinton health care proposal, but he believes some version of it will be passed by Congress this year. I'm Carolyn Clark Kelly in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 4.5 points at 3,845. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up a point at 786. This is NPR. Mexican President Carlos Salinas has declared a unilateral ceasefire in the battle against peasants in the southern state of Chiapas. Salinas also says he will pardon guerrilla fighters who lay down their arms. The army is under orders not to fight unless attacked. More than 100 people have been killed since the Zapatista National Liberation Army launched their rebellion against the Mexican government on New Year's Day. They are protesting the government's treatment of Mexican peasants. France and China are resuming full diplomatic relations. Ties between both nations soured a year ago after Paris chose to sell 60 fighter jets to China's adversary, Taiwan. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The announcement was made in a joint statement released in Beijing and Paris. In it, China promises to stop discriminating against French firms and to give France equal treatment in the rewarding of business contracts. As for France, it recognizes Taiwan as an integral part of China, and it makes a commitment not to sell more arms to Taiwan. French officials say the agreement will not affect the sale of the 60 Mirage fighter jets to Taiwan. French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé said it's important for France to have good relations with China since it's such a big market. He said he hopes this resumption of normal ties will pave the way for France to take part in the rapid development of the country. Prime Minister Edouard Balladur is expected to visit China in the next few months. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Sarajevo, Bosnia, is still being struck by heavy mortar shells. The Red Cross office in the Bosnian capital suffered a direct hit yesterday. One person reportedly died. Despite the ongoing warfare, the United Nations has resumed relief flights to the city. They were suspended yesterday when the runway was hit by a rocket. Red Cross flights aren't expected to resume until tomorrow at the earliest. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The dead can reveal many secrets to the living if you know what to look for. My guest, Dr. Michael Bodden, knows. He's a forensic pathologist, a medical examiner who performs autopsies on people who have died unnatural or mysterious deaths. Dr. Bodden is the director of the Forensic Sciences Unit for the New York State Police. He also investigates cases as a consultant to the FBI. He consulted on the investigations into the Kennedy and King assassinations and worked on the cases of Klaus von Bülow, Tawana Brawley, and John Belushi. He's currently working on the World Trade Center bombing. Dr. Bodden is the author of a 1989 memoir called Unnatural Death and is the subject of an HBO documentary called Autopsy. The documentary premieres Monday, January 17th. If the subject of autopsies makes you squeamish, let me warn you that in our interview, some of Dr. Bodden's descriptions are fairly graphic. I asked him first about the kinds of bodies he examines.
There are over 2 million deaths a year in this country. It works out about 92% of all deaths are natural deaths, cancer, heart disease, stroke. And those bodies usually are attended to by the treating physician, and death certificates are issued. When death is unnatural in those 8% of cases, homicide, suicide, accident, they're referred for investigation to the medical examiner or coroner and for determination of cause of death.
Now, as you point out in your book, a medical examiner can not only determine the cause of death in an unnatural death, but the medical examiner becomes an early warning system in identifying new diseases and other problems in society. What kinds of things?
We see any new drug that comes in, with designer drugs, if a new form of LSD or a new form of a narcotic drug comes into the community, we often are the first to identify the drug by finding it in dead people on chemical analysis. We find patterns of disease. If there's suddenly an increase in heart disease deaths in a certain group, as has been found in cocaine users, we can call that to public attention. If somebody comes from another country and dies of a potentially contagious disease, we're the ones who have to identify that disease as people coming from foreign countries through Kennedy Airport, where we found that a number of times.
Let's talk a little bit about the autopsy process. When you're looking at a body, I imagine the first thing you do is just look at it before you even open it up. What are some of the things,
Terry,
that you can... Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Even from what you say, to do a proper medical legal investigation of an unnatural death,
The
first part of it is going to the scene where the body is.
Oh, you go there.
That's correct. In a proper investigation, there's a tremendous amount of information at the scene of death. When I get called on a case that require, or any medical exam that requires a medical exam investigation, going to the scene to find out how long a body has been dead, to find out if there are any hairs or fibers or semen or saliva on the body that have to be identified and protected, is critical. Once the body is brought to the autopsy table, and if the first time I see that body is on the autopsy table, I've already lost a lot of the scientific information that might be useful in the further investigation of the death.
What can you tell by just looking at a dead body? How can you tell by looking at it how long it's been dead?
The body's been dead, we can tell by testing for the changes that occur if the body dies. It's amazing, Terry. We go through life, and if we cut ourselves, we always have red blood coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But about 45% of our blood is solid, is red cells and white cells. And we don't appreciate that. In addition to the heart pumping the blood all around the body, it also churns the blood up. When we give blood in a blood bank, you can see readily how about half the plastic bag fills up with red stuff at the bottom and yellow fluid on the top. That's how the blood normally would separate out. And the reason it doesn't separate out like that in our bodies is because of the churning action of the heart. Once the heart stops beating, the blood stops getting churned up, the red cells start settling down just as it would in a blood bank, and it takes time to discolor the body. Within a few hours, the lower portions of the body have this maroon discolored look caused by the settling red cells, and that gives us an idea of how long somebody's been dead. It tells us if the body's been moved after death or not. So that by looking at the body, one can tell if the person's freshly dead or has been dead 12 hours or in between. In addition to that, we have the stiffness of the body. Even, Quincy and Poirot would go to that, is you can feel the joints and feel how the muscle tightens up because it's not getting the waste products taken away that the blood usually does, and as the urea and the other things build up, the muscles stiffen, and that tells us an idea of how long somebody's been dead, and also the temperature change.
There's a lot that the stomach can tell you when you're doing an autopsy. What could it tell you?
How digestion proceeds, and I like to refer to paraphrase Professor Einstein, that God does not play dice with digestion. When we eat something, the digestion proceeds in an orderly manner. Most meals will be processed by the stomach in less than 2 hours. So if we eat something at breakfast at 8 o'clock, most of 95% of what we've eaten will have been processed and pushed out of the stomach into the small intestine by 10 o'clock in the morning. If we find somebody who has a stomach full of food, it would indicate that person had died less than 2 hours. Also, the stomach contents give us an idea as to what the person ate. If the person ate steak or carrots or vegetables, those materials can be identified in the stomach, and we can determine whether or not the person ate the last known meal or went out someplace else and ate a meal. Sometimes this becomes very important in establishing whether a person's information alibi is correct. When a person dies can become a very important aspect of an investigation.
One stomach revelation that helps solve the case, there's a story in one of your cases in which within the stomach there was pretty much a raw French fry, an undigested French fry, and the French fry had a very distinctive cut to it. And by looking at that cut, one of the police on the case recognized the diner that this person must have eaten in, and that basically helped solve the whole mystery.
Yeah, I think, and he taught me something. It's amazing when the police come to autopsies and district attorneys come to the autopsy, how we learn from each other. In this particular case you're referring to, after I looked at the stomach contents and I said, look, it looks like this young lady had died less than an hour or two after eating. So if you find who her boyfriend was and whom she ate with, there's a good chance that he's involved in the death. He looked at the material and said, Doc, I can do you one better, because the nature, the way that French fry was cut was not the usual McDonald's fast food restaurant, but was done in a way that a certain diner that the police officer would eat at recognized, and that's what solved the crime. And he was able on that basis to solve to find out who this unidentified woman was and to solve the crime.
He was able to go to the diner, give him a picture of the dead woman. They recognized the dead woman at the diner and knew who she had her last meal with.
Absolutely. Yeah, without and that is how our leads can help. But it's a mutual process, and I think with the, you know, what's happened when I started out in the, in this field in the 1960s, most homicides were solved by confessions.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, confessions don't have the same weight as they used to for various reasons. Some very good. But there's also been a burgeoning of scientific evidence that's independent material that can tell what happened without the confession. And unless the doctors doing the autopsies know how to do the, to read the body, you said how we look at a body, we read, we talk with the dead body from our experience. Unless there are doctors trained to do this, the homicide resolution rate, accountability is going to diminish even further. What? Why would people stop killing other people if, for example, there was no reasonable chance they were going to get caught? It has to be shown that if somebody commits a homicide, there's a reasonable chance he's going to be caught and brought to justice and go to jail. Less than half of all murderers in this country spend any jail time. And part of that is because we're not using the forensic evidence, the scientific evidence, the stomach contents evidence, etc.
Do you think of yourself as part detective, part doctor?
I think of myself as part detective, but not in the Quincy sense. You see, my concern is not who done it. My concern is what happened. I'm a detective in how people die and what kind of evidence they leave behind. Whenever two people come into contact, each leaves something of the other on the other individual.
What, like a hair, a fiber?
Hairs, fibers, semen, blood. In order for a perpetrator to get into a house, he's got to walk over. He's got to walk. There's often shoe prints, tire prints. All this evidence becomes important in identifying who was there, who did what to whom. Getting the clothing of the suspect is important, as well as getting the clothing of the decedent, because there's a transfer of information. We shake hands. We transfer bacteria. Occasionally, bacteria have been used to solve crimes. So there's a lot of scientific evidence that can be used that replaces much more fairly the confession. But most jurisdictions lose the value of solving cases by confession and have not had the ability to use the scientific evidence. We have more than a dozen states in this country that don't have a single forensic pathologist, single medical examiner who's trained in this area in the whole state.
My guest is medical examiner Michael Bodden. He's the subject of a documentary that premieres January 17th on HBO called Autopsy, Confessions of a Medical Examiner. We'll be right back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Michael Bodden, medical examiner. He's director of New York State's Forensic Sciences Unit, and he consults to the FBI. Now, you headed the forensic pathology investigation for the 1977 Congressional Commission on Assassinations. You reviewed the evidence in the John F. Kennedy assassination, and you believe that it was a single bullet.
Yeah, well, there were two bullets, but one of them was the so-called magic bullet that Oliver Stone doesn't like. Clearly, in reviewing President Kennedy's autopsy, lots of mistakes were made in that autopsy. It was a poorly done autopsy by forensic standards, by medical examiner standards. But the bottom line, two rifle wounds from behind from the area where Oswald was, and only two bullets struck the president from behind. One, the single bullet, went through, exited the president's neck, and then struck Governor Connally and went through Governor Connally and was found on a stretcher in Parkland Hospital. There's no magic about it. That bullet went in the normal straight pattern that bullets go in. That was our conclusion. You know, just a sadness that anybody looking at the Zapruder film would have known immediately that the president died of this bullet wound of the head, and there was a second bullet wound that struck him in the back. The cause of death wasn't what was important with President Kennedy. It was all the attendant information, which was an entrance wound at autopsy, what was an exit wound, much of which was done poorly. And it is, I thought, and we members of the committee 30 years ago, thought this would be a wake-up call to the country that this death of President Kennedy is a reflection on the poor ability that this country has to investigate murders, because doctors don't know the difference in entrance wounds and exit wounds normally, as with President Kennedy. But instead, the country and Oliver Stone and all the critics seized upon the errors as being unique, that the only reason there were mistakes made was because there's a cover-up on the president. In actual fact, it was the usual way that autopsies were done 30 years ago by untrained pathologist in forensic pathology. And sadly, it is the same type of autopsies that's going on today.
Now, I know that you're working on the Joel Rifkin case, the case of a serial killer in Long Island. Were you in on identifying that several murders were the work of one killer?
In part. My role in Joel Rifkin is part of the New York State Police Forensic Sciences Unit, and it's just an odd situation where an alert New York State police trooper stopping a car that didn't have proper license plates noticed from odor that there was a decomposing body in the car, spoke to Rifkin, and Rifkin said, I've killed 17 people. We did not know there was a serial murderer out there killing these prostitutes until he confessed to it. And that's, again, part of the deficiencies we have in death investigation. These deaths occurred over many different counties in New York and maybe New Jersey. And when the bodies were found, many of these bodies were not called homicides. They were called cocaine overdose. They were called drowning. And it's just a sadness with Joel Rifkin that when the police rely on the medical examiner or coroner to investigate a death, and if the medical examiner or coroner misses that it's a homicide, the police have no idea that they're looking for a serial murderer. So with Joel Rifkin, again, it's a message to us that we've got to get our act together. And when autopsies are done and people are murdered, if we don't identify them, they're going to repeat those murders. And that's happening more and more. There are more serial murders now. For whatever reason, people can move better nowadays. And unless we stop a serial murder after one or two or three deaths, a string of them are going to happen afterwards. But the role of the New York State Police was in part to work with the different counties to confirm the identification of who these people were and to establish the cause of death. And in fact, these causes of death were suffocation or strangulation, not drowning or cocaine overdose.
What does it do to you psychologically to be working so much with the dead?
That's a frequent question that medical examiners are asked. When we see the dead body, they're out of their misery. It isn't the dead who are in pain. It's the people who are dying. And it's the relatives of people who are dead. But doing autopsies, going to an autopsy room where there may be a half a dozen people who were alive yesterday, who are dead today, isn't as upsetting as going into a cancer ward in a hospital where people are dying gradually from their illnesses. But we know when we go to the autopsy table and somebody has died of alcohol or drugs or a poorly designed automobile, when we didn't have seatbelts, our job is to learn from the dead. This is a tradition among all pathologists. How do we learn from the dead to help the living? And in that sense, it isn't as depressing as it sounds. We also work with living victims. Seeing the living battered child is more depressing to me, to look at the marks and the injuries and say, no, this couldn't have happened in the innocent way the mother says it happened. Somebody intentionally beat up the child. That's much more depressing to me than finding a dead baby who's already out of his or her misery. Because I know when I say to the police, this child was battered, it's not innocent, the difficulties there are still in protecting the child from its hostile environment. We're not set up to provide proper rearing of children who are being beaten up.
You said that you like to learn from the dead how to help the living. Is there an example of that you can give us?
Well, I think seatbelts are very important. When I started out as a medical examiner, we used to see deaths of passengers and drivers with their necks cut through by the glass on the windshield. There were no restraint systems. Babies used to be impaled on ornaments and radio knobs that would stick out of the dashboard. Because of work that medical examiners have done in defining that people die from the secondary impact injury has helped lead to better restraint systems, to safety glass on the windows, to dashboards that aren't hazards when somebody gets into an accident, even to seat belts. So I think the whole area of automobile safety has greatly benefited from the findings that medical examiners have made at autopsy.
Does your line of work make you worry more about violent death, about becoming a victim?
Not so much about becoming a victim. And it's amazing, Terry, when you say, when you get up and testify in court and you see the bad guys as defendants, do you get worried about retribution? Absolutely not. Never have I heard in this country, except on Perry Mason, of the bad guy taking out the outcome of being found guilty on the medical examiner. I sort of have the feeling that we're both professionals. He's there listening to see how well I got it. I always have the feeling after I testify, I want to go up to the defendant if he's guilty or whatever and say, did I get it right? Where could I learn from how the blows were occurred? But there's no danger that way. I think that clearly we see the casualness which people are killed in this country. And it's just mind-boggling how life doesn't mean what it used to mean when I was growing up, when I was a kid. People, and this has lots of problems involved, but one of the problems that has to be addressed is you got to find out who done it. And the only way you're going to find out who done it is you have better medical examiners to start off as to find out what happened and how it happened. And that isn't being done.
Dr. Michael Bodden is the director of the Forensic Sciences Unit for the New York State Police. HBO will feature a documentary about him called Autopsy, Confessions of a Medical Examiner. It premieres Monday, January 17th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why do the new Central European democracies have less than full membership in NATO? Coming up, we talk with Timothy Garton Ash about the changing face of Europe. He's the author of In Europe's Name, Germany and the Divided Continent. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a live performance recording of Bellini's opera I Puritani, featuring Luciano Pavarotti and Beverly Sills. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Reports from the White House indicate that President Clinton will ask for a special prosecutor to look into his role in a failed Arkansas real estate deal. A senior administration aide is scheduled to hold a news conference in about half an hour at the White House. Mr. Clinton has resisted asking for a special counsel to look into the matter, but several Democrats have joined Republicans in calling upon the president to ask for the outside investigator. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole held a news conference earlier today. He's calling for Senate hearings into the matter. Dole has no power to hold hearings because Democrats control the Senate, but his demand for a Senate investigation has apparently increased the pressure on the White House for full disclosure of the details. Dole insists he is not saying that President Clinton is guilty of any wrongdoing, but he says he has questions that are not being answered.
I haven't accused the president or Mrs. Clinton of anything, but I know they've got a damage control team working down there made up of political operatives who are pretty known for political hardballs, but we're not into that.
The Republican leader initially compared the situation to the Iran-Contra affair, but he backed away when he was asked if this gives the president's trouble the same magnitude as secret arms sales and the support of a third country rebellion. Health Secretary Donna Shalala says that Head Start, the educational program for four-year-olds, needs an overhaul. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Head Start, said Secretary Shalala, is the most successful preschool and family support program ever created by government.
But over the past few years, there has been growing concern about the uneven quality of some of the individual programs.
Head Start serves about 720,000 children, a third of those eligible. That's one problem, said Shalala. Then she cited a six-month study delivered to her today that says that many Head Start programs have been overwhelmed by needier families. By third grade, Head Start kids are not doing well academically. The National Advisory Committee that conducted the study has recommended that Head Start include newborn babies and children up to 3 years old, that teachers be paid more. Congress has approved $500 million to pay for a few of these changes, three times less than what the Clinton administration asked for last fall. Today, Shalala declined to put a price tag on the reform of Head Start. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The government says that wholesale prices dropped 0.1% in December. This is the fourth monthly decline in a row. The Labor Department says the drop held the producer inflation to a rise of 0.2% for all of last year. The government says December's drop was due to a big decline in energy prices. The federal government will release its report of inflation at the retail level tomorrow. Stock prices were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow lost about 1.5 points to close at 3,848. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Officials from Western and Central Africa have agreed to devalue their regional currency. It's been set against the French franc for the last 45 years. Cindy Shiner of Africa News Service reports from Abidjan.
Leaders from the 14 countries of Africa's CFA franc zone decided in Senegal to devalue the currency by 50%. The CFA had been fixed at 50 to the French franc since 1948 and is now set at 100 to the franc, effective immediately. The monetary relationship with France has been a key remnant of colonial rule in the region. The International Monetary Fund has been pushing for a devaluation of the CFA, which was considered overvalued. Officials hope the devaluation will encourage purchases of locally produced products instead of imports, which will now be more expensive. But the new rate could spark unrest as prices rise and demands are made for pay raises. Regional countries have suffered serious economic setbacks in recent years, with the fall in international prices for main commodities such such as coffee and cocoa. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Abidjan.
The trial of 11 Branch Davidians has opened in San Antonio, Texas. The Branch Davidians are charged with conspiracy to murder four federal agents who died last year in a shootout with sect members at their cult compound. At least six members reportedly died in the gun battle. A 51-day standoff followed, and it ended when the compound burned to the ground. The defendants say they acted in self-defense against excessive government force by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The Supreme Court has heard arguments from cable companies and local broadcasters today. At issue is a must-carry law that forces cable firms to show local broadcast stations even if they'd rather show other cable channels. Cable firms, like the one that owns CNN and the USA Network, say this makes it harder to get new cable programming on the air. But the government and local broadcasters say the law is a legitimate control on a monopolistic industry. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. If one member of NATO was attacked, the other members would respond as if they were attacked. The 16 members of NATO are not ready to extend that commitment to the new democracies of Central Europe, although Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary had sought a timetable for membership. President Clinton attended a NATO summit earlier this week in Brussels. Then he flew to Prague, where he discussed his Partnership for Peace program with leaders of Central European democracies. This program is an alternative to full membership in NATO, which would offer a degree of military cooperation from NATO and the possibility of membership at a future point. My guest, Timothy Garton-Ash, is an expert on Central Europe. His latest book is In Europe's Name, Germany and the Divided Continent. Earlier today, we called him at his home in Oxford. President Clinton is afraid that granting former Soviet bloc countries full membership in NATO would alienate Russia. I asked Timothy Garton-Ash what he thought of that concern.
I think we are worrying too much about the impact of our policy on the balance of power between so-called moderates and hardliners or hawks and doves in Moscow. That balance will be decided above all by what happens inside Russia. Zhirinovsky got his 25% even with the most conciliatory approach from the West. If Russia becomes a democracy, it has nothing to fear from an extension of NATO. If Russia becomes an expansionist dictatorship again, then we need to get the democracies of East Central Europe into NATO as fast as possible.
Well, do you think that the United States and Western Europe would want to lend full military support to Eastern European countries if there was another threat from the Soviet Union?
Eastern Europe no longer exists. We're talking in the first instance about East Central Europe, Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, which are well on the way to being stable democracies. And the answer, certainly in the case of Germany, is quite possibly yes, not least because Germany does not want itself to be the front line of the West. It's had that experience for the last 40 years, and it's not a comfortable place to be. In fact, you'll recall it was the German Defense Minister, Volker Rohr, who pleaded for enlargement of NATO to include Germany's immediate eastern neighbors. And in my view, if the United States had come down on that side of the argument, rather than being obsessed almost with not upsetting Moscow, then you could have had a different outcome, and in my view, a better outcome to the Brussels summit.
What are the differences between full membership in NATO and what is being offered the former Soviet bloc countries under this new proposal?
Well, you know, there was an old joke in Eastern Europe, what's the difference between a democracy and a people's democracy? Answer, the difference between a jacket and a straight jacket. And there is all the difference in the world. The Partnership for Peace is a very vague and insubstantial package, which, in the case of a real threat to these countries' security, offers nothing more than consultation with NATO. So it is in itself offers very little, but there is, I'm glad to say, a window of opportunity still open for the post-communist countries that actually are becoming stable democracies to move towards membership, and I hope that NATO will move more in that direction.
Is it spelled out in the Partnership for Peace what one of the new democracies would have to do to finally become a full member of NATO?
Not at all. Not at all. Very little is spelled out in those partnerships. Everything is still to play for. And I think the answer in practice is threefold. Firstly, a Poland, above all, Hungary or Czech Republic, has to go on making progress towards being a stable democracy and towards a restructuring of their armed forces to make them capable of full NATO membership. Secondly, the United States has to some extent to change its mind. And thirdly, the issue of the Russian attitude probably has to be clarified one way or another. Either a Russia that is more threatening or a Russia that is more clearly democratic and cooperative would make NATO membership for East Central Europe easier.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Garton Ash. His new book is called In Europe's Name, Germany and the Divided Continent. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Timothy Garton Ash, author of the new book In Europe's Name, Germany and the Divided Continent. Let's talk a little bit about how the new democracies of East Central Europe are changing the face of Europe. Some say that the division, the former division of Europe, actually helped bring peace and stability in Europe. Do you think that some of the countries of Europe actually benefited by that former split?
You know, the British Foreign Secretary said to me in December 1989, just after the Berlin Wall had come down, that the system of divided Europe was one under which we lived quite happily for 40 years. And that is to some extent true, particularly for Britain and France, but even for many people in West Germany. A lot of people live quite happily with their backs to the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall also, in a sense, protected us from all the problems and uncertainties of Eastern Europe that now confront us. And the other point, of course, is that, relatively speaking, the balance of power between the big three of the European Community, Germany, France, and Britain, has changed to Germany's advantage and relatively to France and Britain's disadvantage.
Well, what did France and Britain gain in terms of their power, economic or political, while Europe was divided?
Well, firstly, they gained in terms of a certain forced stability in Europe. The division of Europe and the Soviet threat made a lot of things much simpler. But secondly, the international order in Europe was to some extent frozen in its post-Second World War condition, with Britain and France clearly at the top table as still formally occupying powers in Germany and Berlin, with their seats, permanent membership of the United Nations Security Council, and so on. And of course, all that has either gone or been put in question by the end of the Cold War and the end of the division of Germany.
What are some of the other ways in which you think Europe is at a turning point now?
To take the 20th century as our unit, at the beginning of the 20th century, Europe was predominant in the world, a Europe of empires and of nation states. And then, of course, Europe tore itself apart, descending into war and then into the barbarism of two totalitarian dictatorships, communist and fascist. And you can read the story of the last 40 years culminating in the events of 1989 as Europe gradually scrabbling, working its way back up out of the abyss. And the question, perhaps, in the last 5 years of the 20th century is whether we are finally putting Europe back together again into some sort of civilized condition, or whether what in fact we're witnessing is a return to the conflicts and indeed the wars which have characterized much of European history. In other words, what is the normality to which Europe is returning?
Well, what is Europe now? What is the eastern end of Europe now?
The trouble with Europe is that it's the most ill-defined of continents. It doesn't end clearly in the east. It just fades away. And the question where Europe ends in the east is a perennial one, in particular to what extent Russia belongs to Europe. But what one can say is this, that there is a large area which clearly belongs to Europe culturally and historically, which has experienced Western Christianity, the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, all the formative experiences of Western European history, which is not part of the political thing we call Europe, that is, the European Community, or now the European Union. And so that we still have a long way to go before the real historical Europe fits with, coincides with, the political unit Europe that we all talk about, and the political partner of the United States.
The NATO countries are talking again about the possibility of using military force against the Serbs. What do you think are the reasons for and against military intervention?
Well, the obvious argument against is that this is a quagmire, a morass, another Vietnam, and that once you get in, you'll never get out with good effect and with honor. I do think that a military intervention now is a much, much more difficult proposition than it would have been back in 1991, when it was essentially a matter of stopping Serbian aggression against another republic of the former Yugoslavia. So I think the arguments are much more finely balanced. Nonetheless, I believe that more must be done to prevent, in particular, the final strangulation of Sarajevo.
So when you look at the pros and the cons, you think something should be done, but not necessarily military intervention?
I think that a carefully calculated military support for keeping Sarajevo alive, at the very least, and keeping the other enclaves in Bosnia alive, is the minimum that should be done. And that would certainly should help to concentrate minds on the political settlement in Bosnia, which is clearly the next step. I also think that a preemptive presence, a larger preemptive presence in Macedonia would be highly advisable, because one can see all too clearly that Macedonia might be the next Bosnia.
Do you think that the situation in the Balkans now is, in a way, a test of how the NATO countries are going to respond militarily in the post-Cold War world?
It's clearly that. By the way, in the first instance, it was a test of how Europe was going to, and I mean the political Western Europe, was going to behave in the post-Cold War world, because, of course, this was the first great test of the so-called common foreign and security policy envisaged in the Maastricht Treaty. And many people in Europe said, leave it to us, this is Europe's problem, a message that was gladly heard, of course, in the United States. And what a mess we made of it. So in the first place, it was a test for Europe, a test which Europe has so far failed. I think it has now become a test for NATO.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Timothy Garton Ash is the author of In Europe's Name, Germany and the Divided Continent. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is overseas, but he's actually making news at home. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will we have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. It concerns the Whitewater affair. President Clinton has asked for the appointment of a special counsel. His financial involvement with a real estate company in Arkansas would be investigated. In other news, Mexico's president, Carlos Salinas de Gortari, announces a ceasefire in Chiapas State, a unilateral ceasefire offered to the rebels who moved to take over several towns on New Year's Day. Wade Goodwin reports from San Antonio on the Branch Davidian trial. And I'll talk with Leon Fleischer, once America's finest young pianist. Now he's conducting and teaching and playing piano compositions written for the left hand only.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two of the most beloved opera stars of the last 20 years, tenor Luciano Pavarotti and soprano Beverly Sills, never recorded together in a studio. But now you can hear them together on a new release of a 22-year-old performance of Bellini's I Puritani that was recorded live. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
A couple of months ago, I went to Boston Garden, home of the Celtics and the Bruins, to review a recital by Luciano Pavarotti. 13,000 fans paid as much as $175 per ticket. Pavarotti himself sang barely over half an hour's worth of music, in dribs and drabs of 2 or 3 minutes apiece, between endless stretches of opera overtures and flute solos. The audience cheered. Someone interrupted an aria by yelling, "I love you!" Pavarotti is now 58 and is still in good voice, though he didn't sing his trademark showpiece, Nessun Dorma, and he blew a few notes, something I've never heard him do before. What's even more disturbing is that aside from waving his white handkerchief, he didn't seem to be putting much effort into this performance. But if Pavarotti is the icon he is today, it's because of the kind of singing he was doing 20 years ago. Legato Classics has just issued a live performance recorded in Philadelphia in 1972 of Bellini's last opera, I Puritani, The Puritans, the saddest opera with a happy ending ever written. In the leading roles are Beverly Sills, who was already a bel canto superstar, and Pavarotti, who was just getting there. His entrance gets applause, though not as much as hers. As far as I know, it's their only appearance together, and they're both in spectacular voice. Pavarotti's perfectly placed clarion tone leaps off the top of the staff.
Oh!
Elvira was an ideal role for Sills. As the Puritan maiden forced to marry the wrong man, her voice bubbles with girlish innocence and delicacy. Elvira's big mad scene is very touching, and the faster numbers really glitter. A headline in Variety could read, "Sills Trill Thrills." Both stars have moments of poor taste. Pavarotti holds one high note far longer than necessary. Sills sings one cadenza more in the character of a grand diva than a deranged Puritan maiden. But both take such extraordinary pleasure in their gifts, you wouldn't want to begrudge them their desire to show off. Under Anton Guadagno's stylish conducting, their acting is at least as convincing as it needs to be. It's too bad Pavarotti was never allowed to develop the kind of rapport with Sills that he had with Joan Sutherland. Still, it's a delight to have the two of them at their personal best in this masterpiece of bel canto, the kind of opera in which music itself both reveals and heals the aching heart.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a live recording of Bellini's I Puritani with Luciano Pavarotti and Beverly Sills on Legato Classics. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Devin Reif. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Remember those old educational films you had to sit through in school, like What to Do on a Date and A is for Atom? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Prelinger, who runs an archive containing thousands of old educational, social guidance, and industrial films. Also, Pat Weaver, the former head of NBC who created The Tonight Show and The Today Show. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.